and dispose of this case, but I appreciate you being here early and starting on. And this is Woodbury, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, you may approach.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for response, if I may.
All right, you may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, I want to begin regarding my first assignment of error. And upon further review, I think it is a fair reading that trial counsel did, in fact, waive that as an argument that was pointed out by the Commonwealth. And I agree that the language from the transcript would be sufficient. Plus, the Supreme Court's recent decision in Navarette v. California, I think, causes problems for my argument, even if it had not been waived. So I'll proceed to the second assignment of error. My basis for the assignment of error, the fact that the search of the vehicle, including the trunk area, did violate the Fourth Amendment, is based on the fact that it was not a search incident to arrest. And that, I know that is relied upon by the Commonwealth, and at some point it was by the court, the trial court, in making the decision that it was a valid search. But it's my contention that it was not. Excuse me. First of all, the officer.
I want to be sure I understand. What you had said earlier is that you agree that the probable cause to stop is not before us.
I would have to agree that based on trial counsel's statement that he was not concerned with the stop of the vehicle, I have to concede that.
All right, proceed, please.
Yes, sir. First of all, the initial problem is that the officer who made the stop gave substantially contradicting evidence. Initially, he did say that he did not search the vehicle until he received confirmation information from Officer Tolson, who was the officer who actually did go to the scene of the convenience store, view the videotape, and get additional information. And that was on page 26 of the suppression hearing transcript. And just a few pages later, on page 30, he indicated that the officer who did that investigation may or may not have been on the scene. He later conceded.
Some of that testimony was equivocal, but ultimately, we look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party. And the officer said he was there and confirmed the probable cause before the search began.
Actually, the officer who went to the convenience store and arrived on scene, his testimony was that the search was already conducted and the firearm already recovered before he got on scene.
But that wasn't the other officer's testimony, was it?
Well, actually, the other officer contradicted himself exactly. Initially, and I will concede that he did say that he had received confirmation from Tolson. Then thereafter, he said he wasn't sure if he was and that he conducted the search immediately after he got the occupants out of the vehicle.
Let me ask this. Did the police, and I'll use that term as a collective
yes.
group, did the police have probable cause that he'd committed a felony?
I don't think that was established, because even if the information later would have established probable cause.
Didn't the officer at the convenience store review, didn't the officer at the convenience store review the video and determine that the person did have a gun and wave it around?
Actually, I don't think it was established by the video that it was a gun. It was certainly an item in the stipulation.
Well, didn't he say it was a gun?
Well, but the more important issue is that it's not established when that officer got that information. And I understand what the court is saying is that the police as a collective can pool their information to establish probable cause. But the officer who made the search was not aware that there was probable cause.
But that's my point. Under United States versus Hensley, if what we look to is whether the officer putting the be on the lookout over the air or saying, stop the car, there's a crime's occurred. What we look to is not what the knowledge of the officer who actually affects the stop. What we look at is whether the requesting officer had probable cause.
Yes, but the officer who arguably did have probable cause at some point had not radioed that information at the time that the car was stopped. So the only thing that the officer who stopped the car would have was reasonable, articulable suspicion.
But the officer who stopped the car didn't do so based on anything he observed, he based it upon the information he received from his dispatcher, didn't he?
Yes, but the dispatcher had not received the additional information or confirmation from the other officer.
Well, tell me why Hensley doesn't control.
Because even though an officer making a stop can rely upon information received from another officer, I would argue that they still have to have that information. They can't just assume that another officer somewhere has established probable cause. Even if it's just a good faith reliance upon what another officer has told them, they still have to have that information to be able to effectuate a search. In other words, if they know they have reasonable articulable suspicion, they can't assume that someone else is establishing probable cause on another site.
Sure,
and
that's
another time.
The holding of Hensley, though.
But my interpretation of Hensley is that even though you can look at a collective bit of information, it can't be done in a vacuum. The officers have to be informed of what the other officers know.
In Hensley, the officer who effectuated the arrest simply knew that another, I think it was another state, another jurisdiction, had a warrant for the person.
But that means that another independent...
Or had wanted him arrested.
But that even that is an affirmative declaration that a decision has been made that probable cause exists. If a warrant has already been issued, probable cause has been established. The officer in this case who made the stop did not have that information. All he had was a car description, a license identifier, and the fact that it was a black female and there were two in this vehicle.
But you would agree that Officer Warner at some point said that before he searched that Tolson corroborated the probable the information.
And I'm sorry, I don't know to what exactly you're referring, Your Honor, but I believe Officer Tolson said in the transcript on page 3637 that the search had already been conducted by Officer
Warner
before.
But I think you're picking and choosing what evidence you want to for the court to believe. There was a point where he was clear that he had that the information was corroborated before he searched.
Well, and clearly I'm not making an overall sufficiency argument as far as beyond a reasonable doubt, but there does have to be, I think, a sufficiency or threshold sufficiency for a legal basis for a search.
And if the evidence... Do you acknowledge or not that at some point Warner testified that before he searched, Tolson corroborated the facts?
He did say that at one point, yes, Your Honor. However, that was contradicted by the other officer who said specifically...
Who resolves those conflicts, this court or the trial court?
Well, this court is allowed to review in a suppression hearing all of the information for a factual and legal determination. And again, this is not a factual sufficiency as far as the full weight of the evidence in the trial.
It's probable cause, but...
It is.
How are we fact finders and how do we determine who is credible and who isn't?
Well, I would suggest that if one officer contradicts himself, exactly, not just hedges, but says in one case that he did have confirmation, says in another he did not, and the other officer actually supports that he did not have confirmation, that's evidence in such conflict that is even the Commonwealth's own evidence that there is doubt as to whether or not there's been a probable cause established.
Okay.
Thank you, Ron.
You have 7 minutes left for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee of Commonwealth of Virginia. I'm looking at page 40 of the joint appendix, and it says, you know, Officer Tolson was on scene, but prior to searching the vehicle, just to confirm that there was a weapon implied in the vehicle, the defendant was identified in the video and the scene and the video. So it couldn't be more clear that that's what he's saying at that point. Now, there is some, you know, hedging about whether what she's asking you to do is to look at his testimony that I'm not sure he was at the scene later on at some point or at the beginning when I first pulled the vehicle over and then from there saying, well, I immediately searched the vehicle, and then you're supposed to draw an inference that somehow he's not telling the truth when he very clearly says, or is mistaken or is hedging or something, when he's saying prior to searching the vehicle, just to confirm there was a weapon implied in the vehicle, the defendant was identified in the video. But that couldn't be more clear, his testimony on that point. And so because the evidence in a suppression hearing on appeal is viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. And because he very clearly stated that he had probable cause to search this vehicle before he did so and waited for confirmation, I would certainly argue that this was a valid search incident to arrest. And of course, he does not actually have to have him under arrest as long as he has probable cause to arrest him for it to be a valid search incident. And even if it wasn't a search incident, he had probable cause to arrest him based on the knowledge that he had. This was exigent circumstances because it involved a dangerous conduct, waving a firearm, it involved a vehicle, and there was a small child in the vehicle. So under those circumstances, I would argue under either theory, the court was correct in upholding the search of this vehicle. I would just also note that the argument about the fruit of the poisonous tree involving the confession being a fruit of this unlawful search was not preserved below also. I think she's conceded the first point as to the stop, so I'm not going to belabor that. This case is distinguishable from Ramey for a variety of reasons, and I think most importantly is that this really is more similar to the circumstances under United States versus Hensley, where all, as the court has noted, all of the collective knowledge of the officers, even if the officer was not there at the scene, the collective knowledge of the officers certainly was established at that point because the officer went immediately to the scene, he looked at the video, he talked to the people, in addition to looking at the video. Whether you could see the gun in the video didn't matter because they testified or gave a stipulation that was introduced at trial that they saw a firearm, or the officer also said that he saw that the information that he had was that there was a firearm. So at that point, there was probable cause to believe that this item would be found in the vehicle, and certainly given the short period of time that passed in between, it was reasonable and it's probable cause to pull over this vehicle.
You said Ramey is distinguishable.
Ramey is, I'm sorry. She cites Ramey. And I've gone through on brief the reasons why this case is distinguishable.
It was the one where the drug dog alerted to marijuana and they searched each person, and then since they didn't find anything on anybody else, they said, well, it must be on the last guy. Supreme Court said that doesn't do.
Right, and I think that the point was is that the information was that there was some information that this person was somehow involved in gang involvement, but that this was much more specific of as to her conduct, and the information that the officer had was much more specific, and the collective information that the police had was obviously much more specific. So unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that
questions?
You affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Bourne. Ms. Burks.
Yes, sir. Thank you. First of all, I don't concede that it was waived, that any evidence obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment was waived. That's indicated in the motion to suppress, so that I think that any evidence flowing from an illegal arrest and search is still properly before this court. The evidence did not establish when the probable cause was established, and therefore I think that is also a fine point for this court to consider, is that even if the collective established probable cause, when did that occur, and if it occurred after the search, then that is also of significance. First of all, second of all, the officer on the scene did not have specific information about the black female other than she was a black female and therefore could not affect an arrest. And he even conceded in his testimony that he was only conducting an investigative stop. There were two black females in the car. You have to have a particularized probable cause, or you have to have reasonable articulable suspicion that's individualized as well. But he could not have arrested one or both of those females without knowing which
didn't
one.
Didn't have probable cause to believe that there's a weapon that was used in the crime, probable cause to believe that gun is in the car?
Yes, but if you don't have probable cause to arrest, then it's guided by Michigan v. Long, which requires that you can seize items that you have probable cause to believe
when a person is possession of a vehicle has not been arrested, so we're still looking at wingspan or a safety issue, you have to have probable cause to believe seizable items are in the vehicle, and that it's not practical to secure a warrant. And as I indicated in my brief, if that is the case, if they had probable cause to believe that this vehicle had evidence in the trunk, probable cause to believe there was evidence in the truck that was seizable, then they still had an affirmative duty to go get a warrant. And since there were other officers that arrived on scene later, there was no reason why they could not have stopped and kept a status quo of the scene, obtained independent judicial determination that probable cause exists, and then conduct a search.
What do they do with the vehicle while they're off getting this warrant? Do they let it go?
No, the car was stopped, and I've conceded that it was lawfully stopped. It's not.
You keep it stopped there.
Yes, well, there.
By that time, you did have. That solved your timeline problem that you suggested at the first of this rebuttal argument, that we never knew when there was probable cause to arrest.
Well,
went off and did that, they would have had it.
Well, but what I'm conceding is that when the search took place, probable cause, it is unknown and unestablished that probable cause was known to any officer anywhere at any time. And so if a search was conducted prior to that information being determined, then it was in violation of the Fourth Amendment. I think that's my
argument. You cite a case where an appellate court has required a warrant to search a vehicle or vehicle's trunk.
When there, actually I cited Glover along with Michigan v. Long and Carroll v. U.S., which is an older United States Supreme Court case, but that established the two-prong requirement when an arrest has not been effected or when a probable cause for an arrest has not been established.
Were those cases where the search was for evidence of the crime?
Yes, because I believe in those cases the... And an additional Fourth Circuit case, Carter, U.S. v. Carter, that also involved a canine alert. And the holding in that case is the canine alert on the driver's side of the vehicle was insufficient to justify the search of a trunk. If there are no further questions, I'll concede the round.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll greet counsel.